Good afternoon and welcome. Thanks for being with us. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall, and today it's the midday news wrap. We begin with the latest on the collapse of the Key Bridge. Crews continue to remove containers from the cargo ship Dali. The ship was carrying thousands of containers. Workers need to extricate 178 of them so the pieces of the bridge that fell directly on the ship can be salvaged and the Dali can be moved. As of Wednesday, 32 containers had been removed. The temporary channels that the Army Corps of Engineers have established have made it possible for more than 30 vessels to pass through the port so far. Those channels are more shallow than the one the Dali was traversing when it crashed into the bridge on March 26th. Officials have predicted that they will have the main channel in the port reopened by the end of May. Yesterday, the Moore Miller administration launched the Francis Scott Key Bridge Collapse Response website as a central hub for resources and programs at the federal, state, and local level for folks affected by the collapse of the bridge. NTSB Chairwoman Jennifer Homendy told the Senate Commerce Committee this week that at this early point in the investigation, the focus is on the Dali's electrical system, as officials search for answers as to why the ship lost power before it slammed into the bridge. And Maryland lawmakers ended their 2024 session in Annapolis on Monday night. Coming up on the news wrap, we'll check in with WYPR News Director Matt Bush and Maryland Matters founding editor Josh Kurtz about what legislation made it through the process to reach the governor's desk. But we begin with Hallie Miller of the Baltimore Banner. We've got some polling data about some of the primary races that we're paying close attention to. By the end of last month, nearly 600,000 people had requested a mail-in ballot. Early voting at poll centers starts in less than 3 weeks, and primary day is Tuesday, May 14th. Hallie Miller joins me here in Studio A. It's good to see you.
You too, Tom.
So what can you tell us about the mayor's race? Things have changed since the last time the Sarah T. Hughes Center at Goucher College with the Banner did a poll in the fall. What's going on?
That's right. There's been a turnaround for Mayor Scott. This poll shows that he has gained in the polls since the last poll. It's still probably too early to call it a lead for him, but his numbers have clearly improved across the board in terms of the vote that the random sampling captured, his approval rating, his favorability rating, how people have viewed him since the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed. All of those numbers look very good for him.
So this poll was taken after the bridge collapsed. So it does take into account voters' response to his actions after that.
That's right. It was taken about a week after, so early April. 70% of those polled said he has done a good or excellent job in response to that tragedy.
70%, that's a lot. Mm-hmm. And Sheila Dixon, his closest rival, again, you know, obviously running for the third time since she left office 13 years ago, she was at 39% favorable, or 39% said they planned to vote for her back in September. That number has slipped to 32%. Mayor Scott's at 40, so that's an 8-point lead at the moment. And again, these are snapshots. This was, you know, a few days ago when this poll was taken. What do you think accounts for this?
There are probably several factors accounting for this. One thing that our pollster, Malia Cromer, thinks is happening is the influence of the entrance of Thiru Vignaraja, the former Deputy Attorney General of Maryland. When people were polled in September, 23% wanted another candidate. They didn't like the two choices, the binary between Scott and former Mayor Dixon. Thoreau now has 11% of the vote. In addition to that, a lot has changed in 6 months. The mayor can message differently on numerous topics, including crime. Homicides are down in Baltimore this year. And last year, in 2023, the year closed with fewer than 300 homicides in a year, which is a big milestone for the city. The economy is in a good place in Baltimore. The GDP is extremely attractive in Baltimore. Unemployment is up. It's super robust. Unemployment is down. So when you look at those kitchen table issues, Scott can effectively message on them better than he probably could 6 months ago because we know more.
Do you think that the there are particular issues, you know, the management of the city? This is an issue that former Mayor Dixon brings up a lot, issues with transportation, issues with housing, particular things other than public safety. Public safety is always the thing that's at the top of the list, and it's no different this time in this poll. It's something like 80% of people say it's the most important issue in the campaign. But have either former Mayor Dixon or Mr. Vigneraj have been able to push any particular issues that are affecting voters one way or the other?
I think when you talk to voters, and certainly we at the Banner spent hours and hours this week talking to people who responded to the poll, management comes up a lot. Dixon's ability to keep people in line and keep them accountable within city government, that comes up a lot. They do view her as a good, effective manager. They also talk about her record on crime. When you look at city numbers and you look at state numbers, and we've polled folks on both state races and city races, crime is the number one issue, both among Maryland voters overall and city voters. So that's, I mean, that really has the power to decide races up and down the ballot. And it's hard to argue with the numbers here right now. It looks like the Scott administration's approach to crime is working in at least some respects in at least some areas. So it's hard for candidates, I think, to go after him on that right now.
Yeah, 2023 was, you know, lower than 2022. And this year so far, it continues to be lower than 2023. So the trend continues in the right direction. There are certain kinds of crimes, carjackings, car thefts, particularly juvenile crime has ticked up a little bit, although over a 10-year period, we talk a lot about this here on Midday, you know, that even juvenile crime is down. But that it's hard to convince people that that's true when they see the carjacking numbers in particular. What about the city council president's race? That's another one. You all have the Banner has a story today saying it's basically a tie between three candidates.
That's right. So the gap is extremely narrow there with City Councilman Zeke Cohen at 27%, incumbent City Council President Nick Mosby at 23%. And Shannon Sneed, who formerly was a city councilwoman, is at 17%. She entered within the last 3 months. So that's another place where the entrance of a candidate seems to have made the race a little bit more competitive for at least the top two front runners right now.
Yeah, so Zeke Cohen was, you know, fairly far out in front of Council President Nick Mosby back in the fall, but that was before Shannon Sneed entered the race. So just like the Vigneraj entry into the mayoral race, it has definitely changed the complexion, hasn't it?
Right. It seems to satisfy that huge number of folks who in September said they wanted another choice. Now they have it. And so it's interesting to see how she will affect the dynamic, whether she'll pull out ahead, whether she'll help the incumbent Nick Mosby, whether she'll continue to add to the anti-Mosby fervor in this race, which Zeke was capturing on his own before. Anything can happen there.
Yeah. And the Senate race, another one that's gained national attention because it's a real chance that Maryland will become a player in the sweepstakes to see whether or not the Senate is, you know, remains in Democratic control. It's a margin of one as we speak. So we've got David Trone running in the Democratic primary against Angela Also Brooks. Mr. Trone, the congressman from the 6th District, Ms. Also Brooks, the Prince George's County executive. And both of them are making, in part, a pitch that says, I'm the best person to go up against Larry Hogan, who is the likely Republican nominee, a late entry into that field. So where does that race stand, both with Mr. Hogan and with Trone and Also Brooks?
So looking at just Trone and Also Brooks, their race is extremely competitive, very, very hotly contested. Trone has a slight edge over Also Brooks at the moment. Her campaign has said, with the amount of money that he's pouring in, he's pledged $50 million or whatever it takes to defeat her. Despite that amount of money, it's still a single-digit race at the moment. So they feel very good about the poll. When you look at either of them versus Governor Larry Hogan in the fall in that likely matchup. Both of them have what's known as a statistical tie with him. So both Trone and also Brooks seem to be in a position where they are neck and neck with Larry Hogan, despite the fact that Trone has the slight advantage in the May primary. Both would seem to have an equal shot at defeating Larry Hogan in the fall.
Yeah, and in the fall, when this campaign becomes a general election race, the Republican National Committee very much has their eyes on Maryland. So I think Larry Hogan will receive a lot of help financially from some pretty heavy hitter Republicans. That there's a lot of reports that Mitch McConnell and others, really pressed Larry Hogan to enter the race. He entered literally hours before the deadline occurred back in February, after saying for months that he wasn't interested in being a senator. But his interest has been piqued, evidently, so we will see how that all works out. Well, thank you so much. Always good to see you. And we will, of course, keep an eye on these things very closely.
Thanks, Tom. Good to see you.
Hallie Miller. She covers housing and other issues for the Baltimore Banner. And this note about a debate that's coming up next week. I'll be moderating a conversation with the major candidates for Baltimore mayor and city council president on Tuesday night at Emmanuel Episcopal Church in Mount Vernon. It's sponsored by the Mount Vernon Belvedere Association and a number of other neighborhood groups. Doors open at 6 o'clock. Again, that's Tuesday night, April 16th. And coming up on the other side of a quick break today, a recap of the 2024 session of the Maryland General Assembly with Matt Bush and Josh Kurtz. If you have questions or comments about the General Assembly, give us a buzz, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around.
This is 88.1 WIPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up Monday, our series of conversations with the candidates continues with Delegate Harry Bhandari. He's one of six Democrats vying to be the nominee for the House of Representatives in the 2nd Congressional District. Delegate Bhandari makes the case for his candidacy on the next Midday, Monday.
Without further ado, recognize the Majority Leader.
Mr. President, I move the Senate of Maryland stand adjourned, sine die.
Without objection, so ordered.
That's Democratic Majority Leader Nancy King declaring an end to the 2024 session of the Maryland General Assembly on Monday night. We continue the Midday News Wrap now with two seasoned Annapolis reporters. Matt Bush is WIPR's news director. He joins me here in Studio A. Good to see you, sir.
Good to see you.
And Josh Kurtz is the founding editor of Maryland Matters, one of our favorite sources for all things Maryland, particularly in the General Assembly. He's with us on Zoom. Hey, Josh.
Hey, Tom.
So, Josh, let's start with you. The budget was a big deal this year. This was something that the House and Senate, both controlled by Democrats, did not see eye to eye when the negotiations started. Walk us through the drama around the budget this year.
Yeah, there was a fair amount of drama. The drama really began before the session began, when it became apparent that there were going to be some pretty big revenue shortfalls, budget deficits projected, not necessarily for this year, but for the next few years. And the question really became, how was the legislature going to address that? The House, from the beginning, decided that it really wanted to push some revenue enhancements and tax increases. And the Senate and Governor Westmore really resisted that. And they were kind of operating on separate but parallel tracks for a long time, and didn't really come together until the last few days of session with a kind of genuine compromise that raises tobacco taxes some, raises some fees on motor vehicle registrations and a few other things, but didn't really address kind of the longer term shortfall issues that the House was seeking to do. And, You know, the House actually passed some significant tax increases. The House tried to get iGaming through, you know, electronic gaming, which would have generated some revenue. The Senate resisted those, and those were ultimately not part of the compromise.
Is this the movie, though, that we're going to watch next year? I mean, are the governor and the Senate president, who were pretty adamant against taking any of these kinds of actions this year, are they kicking the can down the road? There is a structural deficit that everybody's well aware of.
It sure looks like they're kicking the can down the road, Tom. You know, it's funny. There's a kind of accepted wisdom in Annapolis that if you're going to do significant tax increases, you tend to want to do it in the second year of the four-year term. This was the second year of the four-year term. I think both Senate President Bill Ferguson and Governor Moore have been expressing a hope that the economy is going to grow at a robust level, and therefore there wouldn't necessarily be the need to talk about tax increases next year. I think that calculus may have been changed some by the bridge collapse. And so, you know, I think it's almost inevitable we're going to be talking about tax increases again, and you'll see the House pushing some of its prescriptions, and, you know, we'll see what the governor and the Senate do.
Do you put any credence behind the theory that particularly Senate President Ferguson was reluctant to have Democrats pass a tax increase in a year that the Senate, for example, the Senate race here in Maryland is quite competitive? You've got David Trone and Angela Also Brooks vying to be the Democratic nominee to run against Larry Hogan for the seat being vacated by the retirement of Ben Cardin, that even at the state level, passing taxes as a democratically controlled body would be bad news for a Democratic candidate against Larry Hogan.
I think, you know, I think that's possibly one of the factors. I think what we've seen is Governor Hogan has been, you know, he basically made his political bones running against taxes. That was his road to success. That's how he got elected. And he has been harping on this issue already, even when the House started proposing tax increases, when they passed their tax increases. He's still circulating an online petition, trying to get people to sign up to express their dismay with the tax increases, even though, you know, only a fraction of what was being proposed went through in the legislature. So, I mean, I think it was part of the conversation. I'm not sure it was by any means kind of the principal reasons why. I mean, Hogan is going to Hogan, and, you know, that's his narrative, and the legislative debate is going to be focused on other stuff, too.
Right, and we will, of course, have more of Hogan being a verb as the campaign gets narrowed into a general election campaign. And for the record, Matt Bush, you're nodding your head.
Oh, yeah, I absolutely think it's true. If you see what Larry Hogan's been running on so far and a lot of the criticisms he has, it's been about what did end up going up in the budget. So I absolutely think there had to be some kind of calculus about this, you know, from the Democrats. They know how important it is for their party's majority to hold the seat, and they know the popularity of the former governor, too.
Yeah. Let's talk, Matt, about juvenile justice reform. The Senate passed a bill. The House passed a bill. They weren't the same bill. They didn't actually, as far as I know, form an actual official conference committee. They just sort of they chatted amiably about this. And what'd they come up with?
Right. I mean, this was the topic that had so much coverage going into the session. So, you know, this still pretty much does what it all along was. I think, you know, the difference is came down to some, I don't want to say minor things, but some very wonky things. But, you know, this essentially expands the jurisdiction of the Department of Juvenile Services to start taking kids into their system from the ages of 10 to 12 for certain crimes, certain violent crimes. So much of this, you know, a lot of the pressure that I think lawmakers were feeling on this particular issue was coming from media coverage, this media coverage coming despite the fact that crime rates were falling in Baltimore and across the state, that they felt they needed to do something. This is done. I think what's going to be interesting, because we've seen some coverage from the Baltimore Banner and our own Rachel Bay at WYPR is looking at this too, how much this is actually going to impact anyone. How many kids from this age are arrested for these crimes and now will be put into the DJS system? It may not be very many. Now, that may have been the point of the bill, too, that this was the particular crimes they're looking at were things that there weren't a lot of kids doing, but they felt that there were enough that that merited this change. So it'll be interesting to see how this goes. It's obviously a really long bill, a lot of things to really pour through it, but how many kids this is actually going to impact, we'll see.
Interesting. A former federal judge, Andre Davis, who also served as the Baltimore City solicitor, was on this program a few weeks ago, and he made this statement that there is no such thing as juvenile crime, that a 10 or 11-year-old, even if they, you know, commit an act of violence, doesn't have a brain development that allows that child to know what's going on and what he or she is doing. So the whole when we talk about data in this kind of thing, you know, there's a lot of data that you know, the people who objected to this, these revisions of bills that this was passed by the legislature just a couple of years ago. Josh Kurtz, you had a piece in today's paper saying that, you know, there are a few of these bills that pass that the governor may decide to veto. He certainly is being lobbied to veto this juvenile justice reform bill. There was a big op-ed in the Baltimore Sun by Heather Warnken from the University of Baltimore Law School. Any chance that the governor will not support this? I mean, the early indications, I guess, were that he was kind of behind this whole effort, right?
He was. I would be surprised if he vetoed it, but the pressure is unmistakable. And, you know, I mean, he said he was looking for kind of a combination of accountability and compassion. And I think the people who crafted this bill would argue that it strikes that balance. But, you know, I mean, a lot can happen in the 5 or 6 weeks that he has to consider legislation. Again, as you said, Tom, he was kind of a part of these conversations early on, I think less so as they kind of hashed out all the details, but, you know, but he is being pressured on it for sure.
Josh Kurtz is the founding editor of Maryland Matters. Matt Bush is the news director here at WIPR. We're talking about the General Assembly. They had sine die the last night of the assembly. Took place this past Monday. So, Matt, guns were on the minds of legislators this session. There are three bills in particular that made it through. What can Marylanders expect in that regard?
And these bills, particularly one of them, I think the one that probably have the biggest sweeping aspect, finally did pass on the final day, and that allows the Attorney General and his office to sue gun manufacturers if they are found to be negligent in how their weapons can be, or how their products can be used in mass shootings. There's some other states that have done this. Now, the example that was given on the Senate floor on, Monday was about, you know, Glock has a pistol that's a semi-automatic pistol. If you attach a switch or an auto sear to it, which now have also been banned, and one of the other things that happened this year, those have been banned at the state level. They already were at the federal level. But attaching that and making that gun then an automatic rather than a semi-automatic, that could be an example of something that is found to be negligent by the manufacturer, and then would allow the Attorney General to sue should someone commit a mass shooting, let's say, using that particular gun with that particular device attached to it.
So chances of lawsuits about this are pretty high.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, some of the other things that, you know, there was the other bill that passed creates a Center for Firearm Violence Prevention in the State Department of Health that mimics something that President Biden has done at the federal level. That was something that Governor Moore had really pushed for. One thing that did not pass, I found interesting because it did go through, at least on the Senate side, was a tax on essentially gun or firearm sellers in Maryland. That did not go through. I think there were some constitutionality questions about that particular bill.
Yeah, it was proposed by Senator Elfrith.
Right.
And the money was going to go fund places like Shock Trauma here in Baltimore.
Right. So instead, one thing that will be funding Shock Trauma is that there will be an increase in the vehicle registration fee, and that will be one of the things that's going to be funding the Shock Trauma system. But those are the three big ones with guns. Obviously, some really sweeping ones that went through last year. This year, less so. I think some of the things that came through, and obviously two of them are mimicking what's already at the federal level. But whether the Attorney General starts using this power to start suing manufacturers, it will be something for us to watch.
Absolutely. And Josh Kurtz, climate. That was on the mind of the governor, certainly at the beginning of the session. What ended up happening?
The short answer is surprisingly little. I think the longer answer is a little more nuanced. But yeah, I mean, since we've had this climate law on the books that passed in 2022, very ambitious climate law, the question has been kind of how to implement it and how to pay for it.
And that's to get to zero emissions by what, like 2035 or something like that?
2035,
yeah,
right.
So that's basically 10 years, yeah.
Yep, exactly. And so the State Department of the Environment put out a report at the end of 2023 estimating that it would take about $1 billion a year for 10 years for the state to kind of meet its climate mandates. The governor this year laid aside $90 million for that, kind of converting a clean energy fund that had just been basically sitting there to go to some early climate programs. But $90 million isn't anywhere near $10 billion. And there were some other measures to fund climate stuff. Some were very ambitious, others less so, but most didn't really go anywhere this year. And one of the governor's top priorities was passing a bill that's going to make it easier to set up big data centers around the state, which obviously have a huge climate impact. So that's going through. So that almost kind of runs counter to some of the state's climate goals. So I think it was a tough year for climate this session.
Yeah. And as you say, I mean, you know, 10 years, it goes quick. You know, we'll have to see what ends up happening. So Matt, you mentioned fees for vehicles and stuff.
Yeah.
As funding part of shock trauma, but there were, by my count, like 20 bills.
There's always a lot. There's always a lot
about
with
cars and trucks.
Yeah. There's always a lot about that. And I think it's some of the stuff that I think people will feel the impact of most quickly. One that was signed into law the day after, and it was an administration priority, was increasing penalties for work zone speed violations. This comes after it's been been a little more than a year now from the accident that happened on the Beltway last year that killed six construction workers. So effective June 1st.
Yeah, and Lieutenant Governor Aruna Miller chaired a task force that looked into that. Yeah.
So starting June 1st, the penalties double to $80 for up to $80 for a violation. But then starting January 1st of next year, they can go up to $250. Now, what was interesting about this was not just the increase in violations, but where that money was going to go to. And the bill in the end says after the money, they have to, you know, deduct the costs of operating the cameras and, you know, going through the process and all that. Only 25% is going to go to the state police to maintain all that. The other 75% of whatever's left in this balance now goes to the Transportation Trust Fund. There were things brought up about that on the House and Senate floor as this was going through. Given that Maryland's facing shortfalls in paying for future transportation projects, this is now a funding source, but I think it's some that you're going to be suspicious of. There's some other ones that did this too. Now the entire state and the city of Baltimore was able to do this. Now the entire state can use cameras to catch people using dedicated bus lanes when they're not supposed to. And one that I find particularly interesting, also given where it's starting, is that in Montgomery and Prince George's counties, they can now use sensors to catch people. They will place sensors on major roadways that catch people with cars that are louder than the law allows, or vehicles that are louder than the law allows. And in conjunction with
a noise ordinance.
Noise ordinance. But now they can also, like a speed camera or a red light camera, if that sensor says they're violating the noise law, same thing, a ticket can now be issued for violating the noise law in Montgomery and Prince George's counties. And kind of annoying, if things start in Montgomery County, it's kind of like the California of Maryland. If it starts, you know, if they do something, it's going to come to the rest of the state.
Right.
So that's something I think to look forward to. It's something to see interesting how it all gets implemented and all that. But, you know, those are some of the things that are coming out that more use to the automated cameras for various traffic violations in the state.
Right. This doesn't take actual state police personnel to, you know, implement these particular things.
No.
It's just interesting how they would even come up with a guesstimate or a speculative number about how much this will generate in revenue.
Right.
You know, first year it's $80. The second year it's $250. You wonder why they're waiting to make it $250. I don't know.
Very interesting. Yeah. Lots of questions go on. But, you know, again, given a state that's looking at trying to fund transportation projects, you know, this is obviously without having to raise taxes on it initially. We know that'll come up again next year. These are ways they're looking at doing it.
And Josh Kurtz, one of the bills that didn't make it through is known as the Medical Aid in Dying Bill. This isn't the first time that proponents have tried to get this through. What happened this year?
Yeah, it's been a long slog for that bill. The last time it was really seriously considered was in the 2019 session, when it passed narrowly in the House and was then killed in the Senate by a tie vote, which was a long story in and of itself. But so advocates finally came back this year and seem to think they had a fair amount of momentum. The Senate President Bill Ferguson said he was for it and, guaranteed that there'd be a vote on the floor for it. But basically, it got bogged down in committee. It was in the Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee, and ultimately, that committee is chaired by one of the original sponsors of the bill. The vice chair of that committee was the sponsor of the bill this time, but between some black members of the committee and some conservative members of the committee, there is enough opposition not to get it moved, and the House basically decided they weren't going to act until they saw that it was going to get to the Senate. And so this is a very, controversial bill. People get very emotional about it. And the question is it dead now for the rest of this legislative term, which is, going to run through the end of 2026? Do they try to send it to a different committee in the Senate next year? Do they try to change membership on the Judicial Proceedings Committee? I mean, I think there are kind of a variety of scenarios, but I think its kind of quick and early demise was somewhat surprising.
Yeah, and as you say, it's a very emotional issue. I mean, there are some bills like, they passed an increase in the surcharge on vehicle registration fees. And as of the 1st of July this summer, it's going to go from $17 to $40. Everybody will feel that every 2 years when you re-register your car. But something like this, a medical aid in dying, Josh, a very different kind of bill, kind of the consideration, the approach to it, very different because it's not a dollars and cents bill. It's a very emotional bill. So it'll be interesting to see. Do you expect that this will be reintroduced again next year?
Well, I don't think it's going to get reintroduced unless either some changes are made to the committees or to where the committee of jurisdiction. I don't think people are going to. I'm not sure a lot of people are going to be changing their positions. I think chances are if it got to the Senate floor, it would pass, but it's got to get out of a committee first. So I think there's going to be a lot of soul-searching discussions about what to do with it over the next several months.
Yeah. And Matt, my sources in the Moore administration are very happy about the fact that the governor's agenda, the 16 or so bills that he proposed at the outset of the session, all made it through. What's your take? Did the governor have a good session?
I think so. I mean, he's able to tout that number, which I think is important. For him, and to say that a lot of these did pass with bipartisan support. So I think so, but a lot, I think now the focus on this was again pre-March 26th and the bridge collapsing. I think a lot of what success will now be viewed as not just by the legislature, the Moore administration, but I think a lot of things is how the bridge clean up and rebuild goes. And they obviously passed the Port Act, which gave them, ability to get money to impacted workers and businesses. But I think that, that's something that was kind of an easy lift. I think no one was wanted to leave those people out in the lurch. So where I think a lot of judgment will come over the next year is how will the cleanup and rebuild of the bridge go?
Yeah. And Josh Kurtz, in this Goucher College banner poll that we were just talking about earlier in the show with Hallie Miller, showed that Governor Moore had a 70% approval rating with his handling of the bridge collapse. Not dissimilar to Larry Hogan and his approval numbers going way up when he was the person that the sort of the face of the state response to the COVID crisis. What's your take on the governor's agenda going in and what came out? Do you think it was a surprise? Do you think it was an achievement? How do you view it?
I would say a couple of things. I mean, Matt is right, kind of going forward now, the handling of the bridge disaster and its aftermath is going to be what the governor is judged by for the foreseeable future. And, so far, so good, as that poll shows. And certainly 16 for 16 is a pretty good, you can't get much better than that when you're talking about passing your bills. I think there is some sense among lawmakers, they might not say it publicly, but they wished they had seen more leadership from this governor on things like whether this was the time to raise taxes or, you know, kind of preferences on certain weighty discussions that they didn't see. I would argue that a bunch of the bills that got passed were hard to be against. I mean, you know, veterans and their families, those are, you know, that's, you know, road safety for workers. Those are pretty good bills, you know, not too controversial. So, I mean, he had a good session. I think it'll be interesting to see if he kind of weighs in and expends some political capital on stuff going forward. There hasn't been quite as much of that so far, but you know, we'll see. And again, now the bridge kind of comes into play. So
yeah,
we'll see how it all goes.
Yeah, and you know, it does take somebody to propose the bills, and the governor did do that. You know, so right. Even if they are bills that are, you know, sort of, you know, intrinsically popular, but he does do it, and it's certainly, you know, a continuation of a very different approach to legislating and a different approach to governing than his predecessor, who, as far as I know, never once testified in front of a committee about a bill, never had his cabinet people go and testify, never proposed any particular legislation in 8 years. So it's a very different way of doing business. And Matt, you know, you mentioned the Port Act did pass. You know, the legislature was able to act quickly on that after the bridge collapse of the 26th of March. This is a bill that's going to subsidize unemployment. Mm-hmm. I spoke with somebody in Senate President Ferguson's office this morning about the difference between that bill and unemployment in general. Some of these longshoremen are making, you know, very, very significant money mm-hmm. in terms of their compensation under normal times. And unemployment has a cap. I think it's $425 yep. a week. So this is going to subsidize that resource that they have. And then the governor did stand up a new website that has all of the possible areas of resources that people affected by the bridge collapse, because it's not just the port workers, mm-hmm. it's the people in the businesses that support the port workers. But this is going to have a deleterious effect on the budget of the state of Maryland looking down the road, isn't it? I mean, how can it not?
Yeah, and as long as the funding fight exists in Congress to rebuild the bridge, which that exists right now, we'll see. I mean, and the only other thing they did with the bridge, they did pass it on the final day, was they basically allowed the attorney general to be able to sue over the bridge now, too, to bring lawsuits. That's something they completely rewrote a bill to allow that, too. So if the state's looking for money, that might be a way that does allow them to recoup some.
All right, and we got to go, but the bill that you've paid the most close attention to, the Persimmons State Fruit
Bill. Failed. The sources were that Big Pawpaw took it down. That's what I heard in the bullpen. But we did redefine shellfish in Maryland.
That's right.
It's now all bivalves instead of just oysters and clams. They want more scallops in the bay. That's why they did it.
All right. Well, I, for one, will sleep better because of it, let me tell you. Josh Kurtz, the founding editor of Maryland Matters. Thanks, Josh. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Tom.
And Matt Bush, the news director here at WIPR. You will get your state fruit, I promise you.
It will happen. I have no vested interest.
Yes, you do. All right. Thanks so much, Matt. Up next, Midday Theater critic J. Wynn Russick reviews Gem of the Ocean, a play by August Wilson at the Arena Players here in Baltimore. I'm Tom Hall. Stick around. We will be right back.
This is 88.1 WIPR.